Baker's Cinnamon brings you the Globetrotters News Digest. A man with wings raves West Virginia pilot. Police had their hands full Thursday when Barnaby Pope, a freelance pilot, raved to them about a winged man he had witnessed during his last flight. He described a demonic creature, dark-featured and with the wings of a bat, flying alongside his Curtiss JN-4 at a cruising altitude of some 1,200 feet. "It was a man with wings," exclaimed the pilot to an astonished pair of officers. The Pope family is well known in Falcon County, where they maintained a farm for generations. Barnaby Pope is the last of his line. And after serving 4 years as a supply pilot for the Air Force, Pope spent his post-war years converting the pasture into an airstrip, from which he transports passengers and materiel for various coal companies. Police attributed the aviator's story to elevation sickness and prolonged exhaustion.
The Adventures of Elizabeth Crown presents Lair of the Shadow Men, Episode 1, April 1921. Elizabeth Crown heard the airplane before she saw it, a low buzz across the gray sky, growing louder. First, it was a blur within the clouds, then a shape. Then a narrow fuselage between a pair of wings. The plane tipped sideways, banking into the forested hills, before it glided into a final descent. The wheels struck grass, and the plane bounced over the well-mowed field. The plane taxied toward a leaning red barn, and then, at last, the engine sputtered. The propeller whirled to a stop, and the aircraft went still. "Not bad for a lunatic," Elizabeth mumbled. The valley resumed its antediluvian quiet. Fog devoured the hills and trees, and leaf-studded branches reached abstractly from the gray. Crows cawed from strands of barbed wire. The moist air was ambiguously warm, neither hot nor cold, just sticky. Elizabeth trudged her way down the pebbled road, resenting the cool sweat pasted to her forehead. The man who pulled himself from the cockpit was big in every sense, tall, burly, his gut barely contained by belt or leather bomber. But his most prominent bulk was a beard, curly and free. Gray streaks ran down the unkempt mass, contrasting with the perfectly curled horns of his mustache. Through the massive goggles, Elizabeth could see the man blink with surprise. He stripped the lenses from his eyes and plodded toward her in his knee-high boots.
"Howdy," he said.
Elizabeth smirked. "Barnaby Pope, I presume?"
"Sure am," he said.
He spat a thunderbolt of saliva into the grass.
"What can I do you for?"
"My name is Elizabeth Crown," she said. She waited a moment for a sign of recognition. "Does that name ring a bell?" The man inhaled through his shotgun nostrils.
"Can't say it does."
"In that case," said Elizabeth, "we're probably both confused. I had a notion you sent me a note."
"Not that I recall," the man replied neutrally. "But you're right. I probably ought to be confused. Are we acquainted?"
"We are now. I'm here about the incident."
"Oh, hell."
The pilot gazed out at the fog. He looked like he might turn away, but then he nodded.
"Well, come on in, so long as you're not hawking Bibles."
Elizabeth smiled. "Get a lot of those around here?"
"You have no idea. Let me just get the bird into its roost."
Barnaby Pope sauntered to the barn, then swung open its broad wood doors. They were made from fresher wood than the rest, and were unnaturally wide. Barnaby returned to the plane, crouched behind the rudder, and groped the tail dragger. With one manly grunt, he pushed the plane into motion, rolling it like a wheelbarrow toward the barn's opening. Elizabeth winced, anxious that the wings might clip the door frame. But Barnaby knew how to maneuver the aircraft, and it safely disappeared into the shadows. Elizabeth was grateful for the promise of shelter. She felt droplets on her forearms, and thunder grumbled in the distance. Her eyes adjusted to the dark interior, and she found not a working barn, but a converted hangar. A workbench lined the far wall, and bulky mechanical parts were strewn everywhere. Barnaby struck a match, and in a few moments, the hangar was warm with the glow of oil lamps. Barnaby took a tool from the bench. It was small, with a black handle and a curved spike. At first, Elizabeth thought it was for the plane, but then the pilot drew a can and stuck the blade into its top. He sawed around the lip, then ripped away the warbled tin circle. He licked brown juice from his thumb. "Hope you don't mind," he said, mixing up the baked beans with a spoon. "I'm half starved." "Be my guest," said Elizabeth.
"And since my mouth is full," added Barnaby, through indeed a full mouth, "maybe you'd like to do some of the talking."
"I always do," said Elizabeth, inviting herself to sit down in a fold-out chair. "I received a letter in the mail. Well, not a letter, but an envelope. There was a newspaper clipping, one you've seen, I'm sure, and an index card."
"A note?"
"Of a sort," said Elizabeth, reaching into her satchel. She pulled out the card and held it toward the lamp. "Just two strings of numbers, which you will likely recognize as coordinates." Barnaby stopped eating. He stuck the spoon into his can and reached for the card. After a minute of study, he said,
"Nice hand."
Elizabeth raised a brow. "I noticed that myself."
"Must be somebody schooled, at least. So if it's somebody around these parts, that alone'll whittle down the suspects."
Elizabeth sniffed. "Any idea what the coordinates are?"
"I'll take a gander at my charts," said Barnaby, resuming his lunch. "But hard to say. For all we know, it's some crackpot. Thinks he found a shadow man."
Elizabeth started. "Shadow man." Barnaby chuckled, then tossed his empty can into the rubbish.
"That's what the hillbillies call 'em. But they've gone by a lot of names. Mothmen, bat boys, spearfinger. Some tall tale about men with wings, living up there in the wild." "Didn't mention that, did they? That there article. Never liked them newspaper men."
"But," said Elizabeth, "is it true? Did you see something?"
"Oh, I saw something," said Barnaby. "Scared the jeepers out of me. Came as close to my cockpit as you are to me. But who knows? Nobody ever accused me of being sane. And this town's got room for more than one crackpot."
"What happened exactly?" Barnaby crossed his arms.
"Well, might as well start at the beginning. See, I took to flying during the war. They needed volunteers, and I just took to it. I've got a mechanical mind, you might say, and I love the freedom of the air. Loved it so much I saved my pennies till I could buy my own. This here plane, it's a Curtiss JN-4, but ask anybody who knows, and they'll call her Jenny. Real popular plane, a couple years ago, and there were plenty of Jennies left over after all the fighting was done, so I found me a good deal. Never liked farming, so I made my land into an airfield."
"Where do you fly?" Elizabeth asked.
"Everywhere and anywhere. Wouldn't be much money in it, except for the coal companies. They always need stuff moved around, and quick. Tools, letters, engineers, all kinds of things. Hills are hard to walk around, never mind an automobile. But it's sure easy to fly over 'em. Ain't a corner of West Virginia I haven't been.
So, it was a shipment. Anything unusual?
I doubt it. Just the usual cargo. Gears and a roller chain, probably to fix some machine somewhere. Anywho, I'm out flying, probably 1,200 feet, like they said. And it's a cloudy day, not the best visibility. And I look to my right, and right there, at 3 o'clock, there's a man. Gray, thin, with big black wings.
Did he have any other limbs, legs, arms?
He did, as a matter of fact. Arms hanging loose. And to be perfectly honest, I thought it was one of them hang gliders. I even smacked my cheek, thinking I was seeing things. But, well, I saw what I saw.
And you told the police?
Hell no. I was shook up, but I ain't dumb. All's I told was a friend of mine, a mechanic in town, name's Jimmy. Thought he'd find it funny. He's always going on about ghosts and spirits. Thought he might have an opinion on it.
Did he?
Oh, he sure did. Blabbed to half the town about it. Next thing I know, it's in the paper. Then another paper, and soon I'm the laughing stock of the county. Can't buy me a jug of milk without some housewife asking if I seen demons lately.
Elizabeth considered this. She grasped her suitcase and rose. I'd like to see where these coordinates lead, and if you're game, I'd like to fly there.
Oh?
Barnaby leaned back, arms spread out across the bench.
How come? What's it to you?
I'm curious, said Elizabeth. I have an interest in things of this kind, and I can pay for the flight, whatever you'll lose in business.
Barnaby looked at the floor and scratched his nose. You ain't afraid of heights?
Not yet, said Elizabeth. How's tomorrow morning?
Weather permitting, mused Barnaby. Sure, why not? Maybe it'll turn out you're as big a loon as I am.
A girl sprinted across the yard. Her bare feet pounded the yellow dirt. A small boy followed close behind, his arms pinwheeling through the air. Hens cackled and flapped their wings. The girl finally threw herself at a pole, smacked her hands against the rough wood, and cried, "Ali Ali Oxen Free!" Other children emerged from the woodwork, of all ages and shapes. Their only common feature was their clothes, smudged, ruffled, and sewn up with patches. They converged in the yard, arguing excitedly about whether the girl had been tagged, whether she'd known it, whether there should be a do-over with all the players returning to their same hiding spots. Some children made their cases passionately, while others leaned against the wood pole that served as their goalpost. The pole itself supported one end of a long clothesline, which sagged with damp laundry. Elizabeth watched the squabble from the road. She hadn't planned to stop, but she couldn't resist a heated game in mid-play. The action took her back to the streets of Oakland during her scrappy girlhood in Pittsburgh, when a single game of Capture the Flag could consume the entire neighborhood, unrestricted by any fence or barking dog. How many kids had run home to their mothers to treat a bloody nose? How many knees were bandaged and shards of glass extracted? And how many came back the same afternoon to rejoin their teams? All at once, Elizabeth swooned with fatigue, and she pressed on toward McMillan's guest house. The building was a robust four-square, and the clapboard walls were old and weathered. Yet Elizabeth spotted two men standing on the veranda roof, brushes in hand. The second story was covered in a fresh coat of canary yellow paint, and she imagined that, in a few days, the building would look quite handsome again. A woman sat on the front steps, blowing rings from a cigarette. She wasn't old, but her face was prematurely wrinkled, and she had surrendered her auburn curls to a headscarf.
"Afternoon, dearie," said the woman.
She waved, flexing all five fingers. Then she gestured to Elizabeth's suitcase.
"Need a room?"
"That I do," said Elizabeth. "Tell me you have one." The woman stubbed out her cigarette and flicked its remains into the bushes.
"You're in luck," she said, slapping her knees and standing. "We have three vacancies, so you can have your pick."
Her name was Edna McMillan. She guided Elizabeth through the house, past warped wallpaper and scraped-up furniture. Despite its age and wear, the guest house was neatly arranged, with potted flowers on windowsills and doilies in all the right places. Elizabeth picked a room on the second floor, mostly for its view of the hills.
"Good choice," the woman said, and they headed down a creaky staircase to the front desk.
Edna filled out the ledger. She wrote slowly, mouthing the words as she composed them. Elizabeth waited, clutching her satchel. She glanced over her shoulder, and something caught her eye. A slight figure stood behind her, in the vestibule. A girl, barely visible in the dim light. She was a raw-boned adolescent, with a simple dress and hair wrapped into a chaotic bun. She slouched over her broom, sluggishly sweeping at the floorboards. The bristles made a hushed sound across the planks, like someone whispering, "Shh, shh."
"Hello there," Elizabeth called out.
When she turned her head back, Edna was frowning.
"Don't expect a reply," she rasped.
Then the hotel keeper leaned forward. She dipped her head low so that her chin nearly touched the desk.
"She can't hear."
The gesture surprised Elizabeth. Why would Edna be whispering if the woman was deaf? And why would she hide her face? Then it dawned on her. The sweeping girl, whoever she was, could probably read lips.
"Tiffany's a good girl, all things considered," Edna continued, still hiding behind Elizabeth's profile. "But always just a little curious."
The sweeping continued behind Elizabeth, the strokes short and trivial.
"You mean she's eavesdropping?"
"Probably.
But who knows? Unless she writes it on her slate, I don't have the faintest idea what's going on in that noggin of hers."
Edna stood up straight and shut her book.
"That'll be $1 for the room and 25 cents for breakfast, dearie."
Elizabeth rolled over in bed, and she blinked into the morning light. She woke gradually from the depths of sleep, as if climbing out of a deep well. Through the window, the sun was a blinding diamond between two hills. She sat up, hearing the old bed frame creak beneath her, and stretched her arms as far as they would go. The room was cool and cozy, and after a full day on the road, she yearned to stay here, pressed beneath a dense quilt. There was a knock at the door, a strange knock, neither hard nor light. Elizabeth took a long breath. She murmured, "Hello?" No answer came. Elizabeth wrestled a foot from her bed sheets, then another. She slinked across the room, mindful of the early hour. She grasped the skeleton key, then pulled open the door. The hall was empty. There were no lights, and a distant window filled the passage with a grayish illumination. For all she could tell, every lodger still slept. All Elizabeth could hear was a muffled snore a few doors down. Then she looked down and saw the folded paper at her feet. Elizabeth returned to her bed and opened the note. She grimaced at the words. The same stock of paper, the same trained penmanship as the note she'd received in Pittsburgh. Meet me at the caves at 2 p.m. Come alone. And further down, Dr. Abbott sent me. Elizabeth dressed slowly. As she buttoned and tied, she considered the note that lay prostrate in her muddled sheets. Dr. Abbott, Royce, her old acquaintance, the boy she'd known from medical school, the friend she'd re-met in Cuba, the man who had secretly sent her to New York. He knew a great deal about her work. A referral made sense. But what would a Manhattan physician have to do with a tiny village in West Virginia? Elizabeth could already guess who sent the note. If this were the only guest house in town, the sender could expect them to cross paths. But what did this mysterious correspondent want? If Elizabeth went to some obscure cave, what was expected of her? She had a dozen theories, but none made sense. She wanted more, a trace, a hint. What she needed now was a busybody. You've been listening to Lair of the Shadow Men, Episode 1. The Adventures of Elizabeth Crown are written and performed by Robert Eisenberg. Music by Naoya Sakamata, Sixamatic, and Eric Satie. To learn more about the exciting field of uncanology, visit elizabethcrown.net. And to support this programming, feel free to visit our Patreon page.